content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the July 2023 Walter Magazine. We begin with the cover story, Birds and Blooms, Exploring the Dix Park Sunflowers Along with Their Many Fans by Anne-Monique Klar. It started as more of an environmental experiment. In 2018, the Raleigh Water Department planted a plot of sunflowers tucked away in Dorothea Dix Park to harvest the seeds for reuse as biofuel. But folks got a glimpse from the greenway and wanted to get closer. We had just planted the sunflowers in this unused nook of space, but quickly realized we should put them someplace where people could actually enjoy them, says Lauren Danforth, head of marketing and communications for Dix Park Conservancy. So the next year, Dix Park planted over 5 acres of sunflowers in the middle of the park, and people showed up in droves. It was more than anything we could have imagined in scope, just this outpouring of people, says Danforth. Now, 4 years later, visiting the blooming sunflower field has become a tradition for many in Raleigh and even out of state, an opportunity to enjoy a natural spectacle with the downtown skyline as a backdrop. It's also popular with natural visitors. The sunflowers are a big welcome mat for all sorts of wildlife to come and enjoy this field that's smack dab in the middle of Raleigh, says Raleigh City horticulturist Neil Weisenbaker. As the flowers bloom, pollinators descend, primarily bees and butterflies, and as the flowers die, their rich seed heads attract all kind of birds, including goldfinches, nuthatches, titmice, grosbeaks, and for the first time last year, a male-painted bunting, a very colorful bird in the cardinal family, not often seen in these parts. People were thrilled. It's not that the painted bunting is so rare, but it was making such a show in the middle of our city, says Weisenbaker. One of the bunting's fans is Dr. W. Jason Miller, a professor at NC State University, an avid birder. The sunflowers attract an unbelievable amount of finches, says Miller, who notes that other notable birds that visit include the chestnut warbler, Mississippi kites, cedar waxwings, and the scarlet tanager. But for him, sighting the painted bunting last year and this summer has been especially memorable. When you hear there's an extraordinary bird in the field, you head there with binoculars. The first time I turned the focus on the lens and saw that kaleidoscope of feathers, I spent 39 straight minutes looking at them, says Miller. My left arm got sore, my right arm got sore, and finally, I just sat down and listened. When you encounter a painted bunting, it's sublime. Miller's one of many birders who visit the park daily this time of year, sometimes more than once a day. The birders tend to arrive first thing in the morning before the crowds. The peak visitors are in the evenings after work or on weekends because midday can be sweltering hot, says Danforth. Over the years, the infrastructure around the sunflower field has grown. There are picnic areas and swings nearby and public-initiated art projects that serve as bee hotels. This year, there will be food trucks and refreshments on site during peak visiting times. The same amount of seeds have been planted as in previous years, about 200,000, and if all goes as planned, the sunflowers will bloom in mid-July for about 2 weeks. Rain, air temperatures, and other factors make the timeline hard to predict. It's amazing to see how the sunflowers have been so embraced by the Raleigh community, says Danforth. It appeals to anyone and everyone, from a bike club to families to folks living in retirement homes. The sunflowers offer such a beautiful intersection of nature and the urban environment, says Weisenbaker. It's so special for people to experience wildlife and for wildlife to experience our city. Next, from the locals department, a lens on Raleigh. Matt Robinson documents a changing skyline with an appreciation for the past and an eye on the future by Susanna Klingenberg. When you look at Raleigh's skyline, what do you see? Perhaps it's history or growth or art, all contours and angles, steel and glass. Or maybe you don't see buildings at all. You just see home. For photographer Matt Robinson, the skyline is a muse. Over the last 23 years, he's made a systematic study of its visual geometry, capturing the evolving shape of what he calls our city's fingerprint. It's a fascination that runs deep. As a child, Robinson was awed by the Pittsburgh skyline, a beacon in the distance of his suburban hometown. It captured my imagination, he says. I held on to that when I moved to Raleigh in 1999. In 2008, when the RBC Plaza, now PNC, was built, Robinson began to see a change in the subject of his work. Downtown Raleigh was at the very beginning of a growth spurt, both in popularity and steel-beamed vertical feet. Demand for images of the skyline increased, and Robinson's passion eventually became his profession. Now his photography business, RaleighSkyline.com, supplies images of the skyline and the wider city to tourism outlets, local businesses, news stations, and a handful of dedicated collectors. The skyline is our area's visual signature, says Karen DeSoller, creative director at the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, and nobody captures it better than Matt. This kind of specialized photography requires a serious command of the camera, of course, but it also requires a working knowledge of meteorology, astronomy, and local geography, along with a whopping dose of patience and a sense of adventure. Most of Robinson's skyline photographs are weeks, sometimes months, in the making, full of research, planning, and waiting for conditions to cooperate. When the moment arrives for the perfect shot, Robinson drops what he's doing, grabs his equipment, and gets the job done. Other great shots involve a little more luck. No matter how much I plan and research, sometimes the conditions for a perfect shot happen spur of the moment, says Robinson. You just have to be there. To that end, he and his wife, Beth, chose to live in southwest Raleigh, near Dorothea Dix Park, an area that gives him quick access to views of the skyline should the perfect opportunity present itself. An avid runner, Robinson often scouts new viewpoints when he's hitting the pavement. He then circles back later with equipment, including his 24-foot tripod, to play around with composition and angle so he's ready when the conditions are right. Ironically, sometimes you have to get pretty far away from downtown to get a good shot of it, he says. Distance compresses the buildings together, which helps you get that classic skyline silhouette. Capturing the Raleigh skyline can be challenging because our downtown buildings are moderate in height and often blocked by trees, and not all of his favorite places to take photographs are easily accessible for a layperson. For pedestrian-safe skyline views, Robinson recommends Dix Flower Cottage, especially at sunset, Boylan Bridge, and Halifax Plaza. Once he's identified a good viewpoint of the skyline, Robinson's next step is to study the skies – It's the backdrop to the buildings, after all, that makes them really shine. For this, he taps into his love of meteorology, kindled by adventuring with his older brother, Dan, who was, at one time, a professional storm chaser. To anticipate conditions for a memorable shot, a storm, rainbow, or well-placed moonrise, for example, he relies most often on two apps, the photographer's ephemeris for moon and sun positioning, and radar scope, which shows raw, high-res data straight from the weather service. The satellite technology and tools available for real-time forecasting now are amazing, says Robinson. Robinson's talent for capturing Raleigh in all conditions has paid off. His work is regularly featured on the news. Matt's photos give us real-life verification of what we're seeing on our computers, says ABC 11 chief meteorologist Don Schwenecker. His work continues to amaze me. For people elsewhere in the world considering a visit or a move to Raleigh, Robinson's photos do the work of invitation, letting them know at a glance that Raleigh is a place they want to be. For those of us already here, his work to something else entirely. It gives us emotional touchstones, fresh views of what we already love. Robinson thinks that feeling of connection boils down to this. A skyline is more than the sum of its parts. You may not feel attached to individual buildings in downtown Raleigh, especially if you live in the far reaches of the city, he says. But when you see the buildings presented together, it makes you feel part of something bigger than yourself. You feel pride of place. Robinson's connection to his subject is more than just aesthetic or professional. To him, it's personal. I've watched Raleigh grow and change for 20 years, and I'm proud of what it's become, says Robinson. What I want most is to enjoy this city for what it is right now. And so he's off, chasing another shot, another angle, a fresh view of the city we call home. Next, from the food department, home cooking. Pam's Farmhouse remains a Raleigh staple by Catherine Curran. The parking lot is always full at Pam's Farmhouse restaurant. Inside a small, unassuming building on Western Boulevard, red vinyl chairs scoot up toward laminate tables topped with condiments like molasses, butter, and Texas Pete. Tan brick walls display North Carolina memorabilia and signed photos from patrons over the years. The restaurant's owner is Pam Medlin, who's originally from nearby Henderson. I started working when I was 13, bussing tables, then came to Raleigh to work at 401 Seafood, she says. She opened Pam's Farmhouse as her own breakfast and lunch spot 27 years ago, after working for years in the industry at old-school Raleigh joints, including Big Ed's and the State Farmers Market restaurant. In fact, she was such a fixture at the farmers market that she worried about how folks would feel about her opening her own spot. I didn't know what my customers would think about me leaving somewhere I'd been for so long, she says. But the response was overwhelmingly positive. Many of those customers followed her over to Pam's Farmhouse, and she's had regulars ever since. We have a neighborhood crowd that comes in every day to drink coffee, says Medlin. There's the grandparents who brought their grandchildren, and now the grandchildren are grown. We've watched so many kids grow up. Today, Pam's Farmhouse is open Tuesday through Saturday, serving up Southern breakfast starting at 6 a.m. and wrapping up at 2 p.m. after lunch. A loyal crowd arrives before it opens most days. There's usually a line out the door. Sit down for breakfast, and you'll be welcomed with a thick ceramic mug full of coffee. In the afternoons, iced tea in a mason jar. Menu staples include a country breakfast with buttery grilled biscuits, as well as lunchtime favorites like hamburger steak smothered in gravy, served with classic sides like chopped collard greens and squash and onions, and macaroni and cheese. Medlin says that her barbecue chicken is the best seller. Pam hands out copies of the handwritten paper lunch menu with the day's fare. Many of my recipes are passed down from family members, says Medlin. The cooking hasn't changed much since most of my kitchen staff has been with me for more than 20 years. Similarly, patrons of Pam's farmhouse come for the food and stay for the community. We don't have customers. We have family members, says Medlin. Becky Sparks has worked as a waitress at Pam's farmhouse for 25 years. I've stayed here for so long for many reasons, she says. It's a family-oriented place where everyone feels welcome when they walk in the door. While things have changed a lot in Raleigh over the last three decades, little has changed at Pam's farmhouse. The decor is just about the same, and customers like the menu as is, Medlin says. I hope to add some different things to the menu, but customers tell me to leave it. Sparks highlights some of her favorites. You've got to try our hotcakes, the Western omelet, link sausage, and, of course, barbecue chicken for lunch. Medlin credits the consistency of food and service to her longtime staff. Many of her team, her girls, as she fondly refers to them, have worked alongside her for decades. Pam is an excellent person to work for. Plus, everyone seems to enjoy coming here, says Sparks. We can't wait for our customers to walk through the door. Medlin's mother works the register, a job that Medlin jokes is her least favorite. There's too many other things to do, she says. Pam's farmhouse has been a mainstay for everyone from families grabbing a weekend breakfast to workers logging weekday business lunch. But as Raleigh grows and expands, Medlin welcomes newcomers to try her home cooking. I always take them something that they probably haven't tried before, she says. They usually love it, and they'll be back. Next, exploring a Raleigh tradition that's equal parts sport and theater in When Wrestling Ruled by Billy Warden. One mid-1960s afternoon, WRAL TV founder and noted opera aficionado A.J. Fletcher lifted his eyes from the bouffant-haired executive assistant with whom he'd been conversing to behold a giant. Parading through the front doors of his office was Haystacks Calhoun, also known in the pro wrestling ring as the Country Boy, all 6'4", 600 pounds of him. Legend has it that a gobsmacked Fletcher remarked, I do believe, Miss Mildred, that that is the largest human being I have ever laid eyes upon. Calhoun was used to astonished stares, in addition to cheers and jeers. For nearly three decades, he, along with such volcanic contenders as Rowdy Roddy Piper, the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, and the Russian Bear, Ivan Koloff, played a part in the thumping and thriving wrestling circuit that included WRAL's studio, nearby Dorton Arena and the Coliseums in Greensboro and Charlotte, along with smaller, sweatier venues rumbling on their foundations around the Carolinas and in Virginia. The roster of talent was stacked, says Austin Idol, a.k.a. the Universal Heartthrob. They all worked for the ambitious Charlotte-based Jim Crockett Promotions. Launched in 1931, the company's titular founder and his heirs steadily stitched together the National Wrestling Alliance's Mid-Atlantic circuit. By early 1960s and through much of the 80s, this carnival of clobber clamored into WRAL to tape a weekly syndicated TV spectacular and associated promos. It was common for grapplers to tumble through 10 shows in 7 days. Guys were making $7,000 a week, but it was tough, says Idol, who wrestled in the region during the early 1980s and now runs a wrestling college in Greenville, South Carolina, where he's also a motivational speaker. Between the travel and matches and getting to the gym, the days could be 14 hours long. Every Wednesday afternoon, a crew would set up the wrestling ring in WRAL's Studio A, complete with mat boards designed to give a little and clatter loudly when giants like Calhoun, Blackjack Mulligan, or Andre the Giant took a spill. Two sets of bleachers, the kind found in schools everywhere, lined one side of the ring. Packing the bleachers was a cast as colorful as the wrestlers. Little old ladies with a flair for foul-mouthed curses, Cub Scout troops, country folks in the big city to see the stars up close, church groups, even orderlies with patience. There was a group that came every week from Dorothea Dix when it was a mental health hospital, says Clarence Williams, who rose from rookie camera operator to director. I always thought it was a strange kind of therapy. There were students from NC State who took great joy in harassing different bad guys, like they would the opponents at a basketball game. The mayhem occasionally inspired spectators to join the fray. I've seen a fan jump in the ring. A few people, actually, says Williams. We had to hire a Raleigh police officer to be on standby in case anyone tried to attack a wrestler, which was crazy because those wrestlers could kill you. The TV tapings were free, but space was limited. Fans had to write in for tickets. To ensure a plumb spot for ogling the pandemonium, diehard devotee Bruce Mitchell from University of North Carolina Greensboro and his pals passed themselves off as a church youth club in the early 80s. He wore a bright green polyester suit to make sure he showed up on the TV screen. The Mid-Atlantic became the most lucrative wrestling promotion in the world in that mid-70s to early 80s heyday, says Mitchell, who went on to become both an elementary school teacher and a celebrated pro wrestling columnist and podcaster. Those wrestlers were some of the best performers in the world. The Balletic Bruisers delivered a handful of iconic wrestling moments at WRAL. The most squirm-inducing one might have been Greg the Hammer Valentine breaking Chief Wahoo McDaniel's leg in 1977. For months afterwards, a gloating Valentine taunted McDaniel, setting up a blockbuster series of revenge bouts. Indeed, the TV tapings were mostly a riot of sound and fury, designed to sell tickets to the marquee matches at nearby Dorton Arena. The most magnificent of those occurred during a roiling thunderstorm in 1985, when the beloved stylin' and profilin' nature boy, Ric Flair, took down a peacocking imposter, daring to tout himself as the real nature boy. Fans filled every seat, as well as the concourse egresses. Dorton Arena was always a great place for wrestling, recalls Mitchell. The moon would shine in those high windows. The ring was in the middle of the place, with just one big light shining down on it. It was magic. This article was edited for Time. From the endnote, Hot Heat, It Does the Soul Good, by Jen Bianchi. There is no reprieve from the boiling cauldron of humidity that surrounds you in the Carolina summer. The heat swallows your thoughts and bends your will. You can't run. You can't hide. You can't deny the ever-present moist warmth crawling into your veins. How can you rebuff such a power? You must become one with it. This is the lesson my grandparents gave to me during summer spent in Emerald Isle. And they did that in one way, with hot coffee first thing in the morning. Hot coffee, to remind you that heat is all you know. Hot coffee, bitter and burning, to prepare you for the sun's mighty forces ahead. From my papa, lesson one. Life is pain. Get used to it. Did he say these words to me? No. Did he hand me a cup of coffee? No. Did he hand me a cup of milk with enough coffee in it to change the color slightly? Yes. Did I pretend that I was a haggard World War II vet just like him? You bet I did. This was our morning routine. Get coffee and walk to the pier. Many a morning was spent watching shrimp boats off the coast. No words exchanged, just that first cup. Sip, sip, repeat. That routine is still with me almost 40 years later. The first cup must be piping hot, drunk in quiet contemplation. With each sip, I return to this mortal coil, and I prepare to face the reality of the blazing day. I have no quarrel with iced coffee drinkers. Do I find them weak? Yes. Do I think they're missing the point of what coffee is? Absolutely. I embrace the heat, the bitterness, the brown. They're in my blood. For those that just moved to the Carolinas and have yet to experience the onslaught that is late summer, let me tell you, you must adapt. Exposure therapy is the only way to make it through. Repent your iced coffee ways and join me. Join me in the madness that is heat on heat. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.